course, initially, but it works remarkably well in a variety of situations. If your child's problem is similar to those of the children described in this chapter, your approach to solving it can be very similar as well. Younger children are usually easier to deal with, but at least after the first 3 months of life, children of all ages with these problems will respond well to the program, if their parents are willing to stick to it. If things are not getting better, the program of progressive weaning is designed to treat only one specific sleep problem. The situation where your child has come to inappropriately associate something you do, or allow him to do, with the process of falling asleep. If this is indeed your child's problem, and it is the only problem, you should have no more than a few difficult nights as he adapts to the new patterns. By the third or fourth night, certainly within a week, everything should be much better. If it isn't, you should be looking for a reason. If a week or so has gone by without improvement, or even worse, if your child's periods of crying have grown longer and more intense, then don't continue the program. Stop and review the situation. There are a number of possibilities to consider before you decide what to do next. You may have made the wrong diagnosis. You may have made the right diagnosis, but be treating only one part of a complex problem. Or you may somehow be treating the problem inappropriately. Procedural considerations. Something you are doing, or not doing, could be interfering with your progress. Some parents have trouble following the program strictly and consistently. Common errors include letting your child fall asleep on his own at bedtime, but then rocking him during the night, staying with him until he falls asleep at bedtime, but insisting that he fall back asleep alone later in the night. Letting him fall asleep alone at bedtime and early in the night, but moving him into your bed when he wakes near morning. Handling his pleas, or crying, differently from night to night. Or responding differently when you think he is making enough noise to wake his siblings. And, in two-parent families, having each parent enforce the program in his or her own way. If you do any of these things, matters may not improve. If you stay out of your child's room for a certain length of time as planned, but then, after checking him, you end up staying in his room until he falls asleep, you will not make much progress. Remember, it is having him finally fall asleep the new way that matters, not the waiting. If you start with short waiting intervals and don't increase their length, your child may come to expect several visits from you before he goes back to sleep. The reason for increasing the times is to reach a point where he is alone long enough to fuss for a while and then settle himself before you have had to go in even once. The best thing you can do for your child at night is to give him a clear and definite understanding of what is to happen. Enforcing routines inconsistently will only make problems worse. Similarly, if you can't enforce consistent, clear rules, you may not see progress. Refer to Chapter 5. Perhaps you insist that your child start falling asleep alone, but you still have to put him back into his room over and over after he runs out. For him, it may be a game. Or you may be unable to insist that he stay in bed all night because he quietly sneaks into your bedroom without waking you. Or you may have stopped allowing him to watch television at bedtime, but he still watches in the middle of the night because there is a television in his room, or because he can sneak into the den. In setting new routines, you will succeed only if you enforce them completely and throughout the entire night. Schedule considerations. The treatment can be undermined if the plan does not take into account your child's daily schedule and biological rhythms. Refer to Chapters 9 through 12. The progressive weaning program assumes that your child is sleepy and capable of sleep at the times when you are using it. If he isn't sleepy, no program, regardless of how strictly and consistently it is applied, can help him fall asleep. If your child has been falling asleep at 9 p.m. and you set his bedtime at 7 p.m., he will have about 2 hours to complain before he even begins to get sleepy. That is why I suggest you start with a bedtime no earlier and probably a little later than the usual time he falls asleep. If you are not sure what time to start with, remember that it is better to err on the late side at first than to put your child to bed when he is still wide awake. You can always move his bedtime earlier again after a few days. Similarly, if your child is usually awake for an hour or two in the middle of the night, but he is happy as long as you are there playing with him, then you may simply be keeping him in bed longer than he can sleep. In that case, he will have an hour or two to fill in the middle of every night before he is capable of falling back asleep. As will be explained in Chapter 11, you will need to cut back the length of time he spends in bed accordingly before you try to teach him a new pattern of associations. If your child loses sleep while you are teaching him new patterns because he is up crying during the night, don't let him sleep later than usual or take more naps or longer ones the next day. If you let him make up in the day the sleep lost at night, you will only succeed in shifting some of his sleep from the nighttime to the daytime, ensuring that he will be awake and crying more the next night. If he ends up short on sleep one night, that's okay. It will actually work to your advantage the next night. If you are not sure when your child is even capable of sleeping, perhaps because his schedule and hours of sleep vary so much from day to day, work on developing a consistent schedule that works for him. You should find a schedule in which he falls asleep quickly at bedtime, even if he needs help to do so, and falls back to sleep quickly after waking during the night. Again, even if he needs help, before you start enforcing a program of changes. Anxiety. Your child may be frightened. If he shows signs of separation anxiety in the daytime, he may not be able to tolerate separation at night. Leaving him alone in his room for longer and longer periods will not help. In fact, it may make matters worse. If that seems to be happening, then choose a multi-step approach, as described earlier and in Chapter 7. You should work on all other associations first and deal with the separation problems later. You may need to sleep in the same room as him all night, but even then you can still insist on sleeping on a separate bed or mattress, refuse to hold or rock him, or eliminate a pacifier. If he keeps pulling at you or getting into your bed, you can still leave the room for increasing periods of time, except that when you return, you should agree to stay as long as the undesirable behavior does not resume. Confusional versus habitual wakings. When you think your child is awake at night, is he really awake? When you go to him, does he respond appropriately, calm down quickly, and let you know what he wants? Or does he push you away and keep thrashing and kicking? Children experiencing a confusional arousal or sleep terror are not awake enough even to realize that you were there, much less to learn new patterns of associations. How to recognize and treat these partial arousals is discussed in Chapter 13. Medical considerations. It is quite uncommon for pain to be the cause of frequent or nightly wakings in children, but you may need to rule out the possibility. A child who is in pain at night can usually be distinguished from one who is simply unhappy. The child who wakes because of pain may be somewhat comforted by being held, but the pain will not go away. He will still show signs of being in pain, and he will not return to sleep quickly. He will probably experience similar periods of pain in the daytime as well. On the other hand, if your child is happy if you hold him, give him his pacifier, or allow him to play, or if he sleeps well when you let him sleep in your bed, then you can be sure that he is not in pain. Pain and other medical situations are discussed further in Chapter 8. General observations. There are some general points that are useful to keep in mind as you try to determine the cause of your child's sleep problem and try to correct it. 1. Changes you need to make to correct a problem of inappropriate sleep associations are not being made solely for your own benefit. More important is that they are also to benefit your child. Being able to fall asleep easily and trusting that things won't change once he does is a better way for your child to go through the night. 2. Ideally, the conditions associated with falling asleep should not be stimulating, like television, and they should not involve continuous activities such as sucking on a bottle or pacifier. It's best for children to learn to fall asleep in a crib or bed in a room that is fairly dark and quiet. No lullaby tapes, CDs, television, or sound machines. After their first few months, children should not need to be held, rocked, or patted, or need to be soothed with a bottle or pacifier, or at the breast, just to fall asleep. Bedtime feedings are fine even after the early months, as long as the child doesn't come to depend on them to fall asleep throughout the night. 3. When children wake during the night, they should be where they were when they fell asleep, with the same people there or not there. They should be able to trust that no changes were made after they fell asleep. They should not have any jobs to do, checking, calling, sucking, eating, watching, listening, pleading, or demanding, before falling back asleep. All they should need is to find a comfortable position and continue quickly into the next sleep cycle. 4. If your child wakes crying at night but quiets rapidly and returns to sleep promptly once you re-establish the conditions that were present at bedtime, such as rocking him in your arms, then you can be certain that he has merely learned to associate the wrong conditions with falling asleep. There is no inherent abnormality in his ability to sleep. The physiological systems that control sleep in a child cannot prevent him from sleeping well only when he is not being held or rocked. If these systems were not working properly, your child would not sleep well under any conditions. So you can be sure that the cause of his sleep disturbance is not a neurological abnormality, a dietary imbalance, or food sensitivity, or significant discomfort. 5. Don't start too young. Parents frequently ask at what age they should start a progressive weaning approach. It is difficult to give a precise answer to this question, but there are some guidelines. Most children start to sleep through the night on their own within 3 or 4 months after birth. Note that all figures here are based on the due date, so they will be later for children born prematurely. Newborns do not sleep through the night, and you should not try to make them. Sleep, particularly REM sleep, in the newborn, is broken by many wakings. At these times and during the periods of change from one sleep state to another, an infant's sleep patterns are particularly vulnerable to disruption. Your newborn should not have to negotiate these periods without comforting and help. At any rate, a full night is too long for a newborn to go between feedings. By the time a child is around 3 months old, significant developmental changes have taken place. Now most sleep should be occurring at night, and the pattern of sleep stage cycling should be fairly mature. Refer to Chapter 2. A baby's sleep patterns often improve markedly around this time, so unless you are having unusually severe problems, it is a good idea to wait until your child is 3 or 4 months old before you institute major changes. If at that point you only need to get up briefly once or twice a night to settle your child, you might want to wait a few weeks and see what happens. Often, such sleep patterns continue to improve on their own. But even a 2-month-old should not be up more than 2 or 3 times during the night. If your baby is up more than that and always goes right back to sleep when you help, you might see if he starts to do better if you do not always respond immediately. Remember, the methods in this chapter are designed to help you treat habits, not other sleep problems. If his sleep does not improve over a few days, you should probably give him the benefit of the doubt and wait a few weeks before trying again. Similarly, as discussed in Chapter 6, you should not have to feed a healthy 2-month-old hourly across the night, and it is fine to start spacing out the feedings then, but it is too early to aim at eliminating them altogether. If a marked problem persists at 3 or 4 months, you can then consider a real effort to make changes. By the time the baby is 5 months old, you can consider making changes even if his sleep problems are relatively minor. 6. Your child's sleep associations at one time, say bedtime, may not always affect what happens at other times, such as later in the night or at nap times. Rocking your child to sleep or patting his back is not necessarily wrong or even certain to cause trouble. If your child falls asleep rapidly, is easy to move to his crib or bed, and sleeps through the night, i.e. puts himself back to sleep quickly after normal wakings, and if you are happy with this routine, then there is no problem at all. For example, even if you rock your child for 5 minutes at bedtime, or nurse him to sleep over 10 minutes, you may be able to transfer him easily into his crib or off you onto the mattress, and he may resettle himself quickly and then sleep through the night. You would have reason to change the routine only if problems emerged. If, for instance, the bedtime routine becomes prolonged, as it was with Betsy, or if your child begins waking most nights and requires your presence each time. To take another example, your child may fall asleep alone at bedtime and nap time, but need to be rocked after nighttime wakings. Or perhaps he falls asleep easily at daycare, even though his sleep associations there differ completely from those he has at home. Children with sleep patterns like these have learned to associate different conditions with falling asleep at different times or in different places. This is no more or less normal than needing the same conditions each time one falls asleep. 7. If your child falls asleep by himself at nap time but needs you at night, then you can expect the relearning to go very quickly. He already knows how to fall asleep on his own. He simply has to learn to associate that behavior with the nighttime as well as with nap times. 8. The amount of help a child needs to settle during the night may vary depending upon the time. A child who wakes frequently at night may sleep well for several hours before his first nighttime waking and after his last one. For example, he may sleep soundly from 7 to 10 p.m. and from 4 to 7 a.m., but be restless, waking frequently between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. This variation is only a reflection of his normal pattern of sleep state cycling. As you learned in Chapter 2, children spend the first few hours of the night in deep sleep, and often return to that same state near morning. During the period of lighter sleep in between, they are more subject to wakings. 9. If you have been going into your child during the night to help him fall back asleep, you may have been told that you were spoiling him. That is not true. Spoiling a child means giving in to his demands regardless of what is best for him. If you are comforting him at night, it is probably because you feel that it is the right thing to do for him, not because you cannot say no or are incapable of discipline. Repeatedly going in to comfort him, however, is often not the best thing to do. By doing so, you may only be strengthening a habit, not responding to a real need. In the daytime, you may find it easier to distinguish your child's wants from his needs, and you can deny him any inappropriate requests without difficulty, even if he cries. But if he wakes and cries at night, and only settles when he is nursed or rocked, you may mistakenly believe that he is hungry and needs to be fed, or that he is in pain. You could also jump to the conclusion that he has some inherent problem that makes it impossible for him to go back to sleep without gentle rocking. You know that a colicky baby of 2 months might need to be walked. You might imagine that by the same token it is appropriate to walk a sleepless, crying child of 6, 18, or 36 months. The real problem here is not that you are spoiling him, but that you do not yet know enough about sleep and sleep associations to distinguish his wants from his needs. Once you understand that what he needs is to learn a new way to fall asleep, whether or not it is what he wants, you will find it easier to see that this need is met. 10. The process of learning new sleep associations will not hurt your child. Parents want their children to feel safe and cared for. When they realize they will have to let a child do some crying, they often fear that the experience will be traumatic, causing permanent psychological harm. While this concern is understandable, long experience has shown that there is nothing to worry about. Allowing some crying while you help your child learn to improve his sleep will never cause psychological damage. It will probably be harder on you than on your baby. Even the most worried parents I have worked with have told me afterward that their concerns about the relearning process proved groundless, and that if anything, once the child's sleep improved, both they and the child were happier. A young child cannot yet understand what is best for him, and he may cry if he does not get what he wants. As his parents, you have to be the judge of what he can and cannot have or do. You want to do what is best for him, and that should include helping him form good sleep patterns. If he wanted to play with a sharp knife, you would not give it to him, no matter how hard he cried, and you would not feel guilty or worry about psychological consequences. Poor sleep patterns are also harmful for your child, and it is your job to correct them. Doing so is a sign of caring, not of selfishness. Of course, if your child does not get enough love and attention overall, then he may well develop psychological problems. But if you consistently show your love and provide warmth and care, then a little extra crying for a week or so, no matter how upset or angry it sounds, will not hurt him in the least. Even when children become more clingy for a day or two, as sometimes happens, the parents are invariably convinced by the rapidity with which this behavior resolves and the child's sleep improves that they have done the right thing. In fact, with respect to possible psychological effects, your family situation can only improve when your child sleeps better at night. He will feel better and be less irritable during the day. If there are no changes or surprises during the night, he will be more trusting. Because of these changes, and because you yourself will be more rested and have less to be angry about, you will enjoy your child's company more, and your interactions with him will improve as well. 11. Since it is important that you follow through on your program consistently, wait for a convenient time to begin. Don't start at a time when you cannot afford to lose sleep yourself, such as before an important meeting or a job interview, or when someone is coming to visit. You may want to wait until a Friday night to begin, so that you have the weekend to catch up on any missed sleep. 12. In most cases, once you decide on a waiting schedule, follow it closely, or at least don't go in too soon. Know ahead of time how long you are supposed to wait, and keep track of the time. 10 minutes can seem like an hour in the middle of the night. Sometimes, too, it may be better not to go in to your crying child, even when the time is up. If you can tell that he is beginning to calm down, you may only interrupt the calming process and make things worse if you go in and leave again. If you sense that waiting a bit longer will actually be easier on him, then wait and see if he continues to calm down on his own. Remember, you can always go in if he becomes more upset. 13. In two-parent households, parents should share the responsibilities, if possible, so that the same adult does not have to handle all bedtime and waking interactions during the relearning period. Your child should feel comfortable with either parent at bedtime and after wakings, so it is better if both parents participate. You do not have to alternate strictly. Just pick a schedule that suits you. One parent may find it easier to get up in the first half of the night, and the other parent may prefer the second. Or work demands may call for one parent to do more on weekends and the other on weekdays. If one parent has handled all the bedtimes and wakings until now, the other parent may have better luck breaking the old associations. When a child cries and one of the parents responds, it is probably best if that parent continues to be the one who responds until the child falls asleep, so that the child won't sense that he can control who comes in by crying enough. For similar reasons, it is good advice not to let your child insist, "I want Mommy," or "I want Daddy." Decide who will handle each night's bedtime routines and stick to it. You will do more to convince your child of your love by staying than by giving in to his demands for the other parent. Once he learns that you really mean that you want to be the one to care for him at that time, he will look forward to it, if it is part of the usual bedtime ritual, and he will be more reassured. The same applies to your responses at nighttime wakings. 14. Occasionally, as parents increase the time they wait before responding, their child cries so hard that he throws up. If that happens, go in even though the time isn't up yet. Clean your child up and change the sheets and pajamas as needed, but do so quickly and matter-of-factly, and then leave again. If you reward him for throwing up by giving him too much attention, he will only learn that vomiting is a good way for him to get what he wants. Occasional vomiting will not hurt your child, so don't feel guilty that it happened. Like the crying, it will soon stop. 15. If you have other children, especially young children, you may be concerned that they will be kept awake by the noise of crying during the relearning period. You probably don't need to worry too much. If the other children wake, tend to them as necessary, but don't let your fear of their being wakened interfere with your ability to stick to the program. Remember, even if their sleep is disturbed for a few nights, it will return to normal quickly. They will probably sleep through most of the fuss anyway. If a child who shares a room with the one doing the relearning complains about the noise, or if it seems to be disturbing him greatly, let him sleep in another room for a few nights. Generally, the child with a sleep problem wants his brother or sister back, and that provides further motivation for him to cooperate. If the child you are helping sleeps in a crib, you can instead move the crib, rather than the sibling, to another room for the few days necessary. 16. When you are considering a program that involves some crying or screaming at night, it may seem that it would only be practical if your family lived alone on a deserted island. If you live in an apartment building, you may have to contend with neighbors and your landlord. Explain to your neighbors what you are doing, and tell them the problem should only last a few nights. Start the program on the weekend if they prefer. If they are not willing to go along, perhaps you can wait until they will be away for a few days. Or you may have to use a very gradual approach in which you stay in the room initially to keep crying to a minimum. 17. During the relearning process, it is better not to use a sitter. But if it becomes necessary for a night or two, let the sitter put your child to bed in whatever way is easiest. It is not fair to ask a sitter, especially a grandparent, to follow your program, and letting a sitter put your child to bed differently will not really affect what he is coming to expect from you. Nothing will be lost, just be sure to restart the program the next day. Once the new routines are well established, however, you might ask your sitter to try them. If your child is left with a sitter most days, the sitter will know your child well, and he or she can participate in the relearning program for nap times. When a sitter or daycare provider handles nap times differently from the way you handle bedtimes, there are usually fewer problems than there would be if you handled both yourself but did so inconsistently. If it is not possible to involve the sitter, or if it seems inadvisable because the sitter is very young perhaps, then you may have to institute the program only at night. It will still work. 18. Once your child has learned to fall asleep by himself with the proper associations, he will probably continue to sleep well, but there may be occasional disruptions. If you are visiting friends or relatives, your child may have to share your room, and you may want to respond to his whimpering quickly so that it doesn't disturb your hosts. Or your child may be sick, perhaps in pain, so you sit with him and take him into your bed. When you get home or the illness passes, he may want to continue going to sleep under these new conditions. If you give in, the temporary change may well develop into an ongoing sleep disturbance. This is a common problem, especially during the second 6 months of life. Making changes on a trip or during an illness is necessary and reasonable. But if these changes lead to new associations that cause your child's sleep to remain disrupted after he is back home or recovered, then all you need to do is to go back to the progressive program described in this chapter for several days to reestablish the proper patterns. Since it is not difficult to reestablish good sleep habits, you should not hesitate to take care of your child in any way he needs if he is ill or frightened or while traveling. In fact, it is important to show him you are available when he truly needs you. That trust makes it easier for him to handle other times by himself. It's best, however, to make as few temporary changes as possible. If you have to spend some extra time in his room, you may not have to stay all night. He may want a cup of water, but you probably won't have to restart feedings or bottles. Do only what is necessary, so he will have less to relearn later. Chapter 5. The Problem of Limit Setting. I want a glass of water. One more story. Another kiss. Requests like these, benign though they may seem, can ruin your evening and disrupt your night as well if they are endlessly repeated. The youngster making these demands could fall asleep if only he would stay in bed and stop calling. This is a problem of limit setting. As you will see, the appearance, causes, and treatments of this problem overlap considerably with those discussed in the chapters on associations, feedings, schedules, and anxieties, and elements of any or all of these can appear in the same child. The problem of limit setting, however, tends to occur more in the toddler and older child than in the infant, and the interactions involved often take place before a child goes to sleep, rather than during the actual transition to sleep itself. Often this problem appears suddenly when a child learns how to climb out of a crib or is moved to a bed. Until then, the bars of the crib represent the parent's authority. The child can call, but he can do little else to get his demands met. Once this control is gone, parents perhaps just assume that their child will continue to stay in bed at night on his own. But for a 2-, 3-, or 4-year-old, or even for an older child, the impulse to get up can be too strong to resist. There might be something he wants to do, or someone he wants to be with. He may hear people talking and laughing, or he may hear nothing and wonder where everyone is. The temptation for your child to be part of whatever is happening outside his room can be overwhelming. He starts to make demands, trying to get you to come back in with whatever else he wants. If you don't respond, he may come out of the room after you, or he may find another way to get you to come in, perhaps by making enough noise to wake a baby brother or sister. Some children only have to threaten to wake their siblings to get the desired response. who's in charge. Children are smart. They do what works and they don't do what doesn't. They may run through a litany of requests, but they will settle on the ones that get the most predictable responses. Most children settle on similar curtain calls, like the typical ones for more water, stories, or kisses, as mentioned at the opening of this chapter. Or, perhaps, rub my back some more. I need to go to the bathroom again. Please tuck me in again. Sing me another song. I want to say good night to Daddy. I need to tell you something. If a child has difficulty with self-control, then it is best if that difficulty can be done away with at bedtime and during the night. Controlling the child is the parent's job, or should be. Ask yourselves, who is in charge? Frequently, when parents describe to me what happens at night in their household, it is clear that they are not. They tell me that they know they shouldn't give their child a second full bottle each night at bedtime, then add, but she demands another bottle. Or they agree that their child should be away from the television and in bed by 9 p.m., then say, but she insists on watching another show. Or after telling me that his wife was to handle all his daughter's bedtime routines, a father may explain that he tries, but she won't accept me. If you find yourself explaining away bedtime difficulties with words like demand, insist, or won't accept, then you are not the one running the show at night. Young children simply should not be allowed to demand or insist on anything that is not necessary, certainly not at bedtime or during the night. If they are given this power, they will use it. The situation goes downhill from there, and rapidly. For example, Megan, a sweet and generally well-behaved four-year-old girl, turns her bedroom into mission control at night. She calls out for a glass of water, but when her father brings it in, she sends him out, saying, "I want Mommy." When her mother returns with the water, she too is sent out because it's in the wrong glass, and then again because it's not full enough. Soon her parents are running upstairs and downstairs trying to meet all her demands. The wrong person is in control, and no one is sleeping. Learning to set limits appropriately is an important part of becoming a parent. All parents do set limits, they just don't all set them for the same reasons or with the same level of consistency. No parents would willingly let their two-year-old play with matches or run into a busy street, no matter how long he protested. They might not like listening to him cry when he is told no, but they are unlikely to feel guilty about it either. And since these rules are firm and absolute, he will eventually stop trying. He would not think better of his parents if they let him do what he thought he wanted, and he was then injured as a result. What lesson would he have learned then? Setting limits is relatively easy, at least emotionally, when the consequences are life and death. You don't feel you are depriving your child when you stop him from playing with the electrical outlet, although you might when the consequences are not so dire. For instance, when you refuse to get him an extra glass of water. But to the young child, these situations are indistinguishable. Both cases are a matter of, I want this. Can I have it? If you set a limit for a good reason, you have no cause to feel guilty or fear that you are hurting your child or losing his love, whether that reason is to protect him from harm or merely to keep his bedtime habits under control. Of course, it is also important that you do not set limits capriciously based on how you feel on a given day, and also that two parents do not set limits differently, which can become an unintended game of good cop, bad cop. Being overly strict is as bad as being overly lax. You should try to find a proper level of firmness, and that level should not change day to day or parent to parent, from daytime to bedtime, or from bedtime to the middle of the night. Nurturance and proper limit setting are not opposites. They are different ways of showing your child how much you care. If limits are set properly, a child will learn that they are in his best interest and that they are a sign of your love and concern. Think of the best teachers you had in school. In all likelihood, these teachers were strict enough to keep your class controlled, but they were also able to communicate their love and caring for each student. If a teacher turns over control to the students, chaos ensues. No attention, no learning. That may be fun for a day, but not for much longer. Difficulty setting limits. Some parents are always able to set limits well. Others set them effectively only during the daytime, weakening at night as they try to avoid battles and get to sleep themselves. Still others set limits poorly and inconsistently at all times. If you are having trouble setting limits, there may be a variety of reasons. You may never have considered how important limits are for your child, and you may never have learned how to go about enforcing them. Aspects of your child's sleep schedule may be undermining your attempts to control his nighttime behavior. You may have feelings of guilt that make it hard for you to be firm. Your child's resistance at bedtime may have indirect benefits for you, secondary gain, which can, in turn, make you reluctant to follow through consistently, if at all. Finally, there may be underlying problems at home that interfere with your ability to control your anger and set and enforce proper limits while remaining nurturing and supportive. Let's consider each of these issues in turn. Knowing why limits are important and how to set them. If you think it's tolerable that your 4-year-old son comes into your bed each night against your will and kicks you or your partner until one of you has to move to another room, then you may not understand the importance of setting and enforcing rules. The same could be said if you see nothing wrong with letting your child determine when and where he will eat, what television shows he will watch, and when he goes to bed, or if you believe you should always buy him anything he wants, to keep him from throwing tantrums in public, perhaps. If you know these scenarios are wrong, but you don't know how to change them, if you can't keep your 2-year-old in his room after you say good night, or can't even avoid going back to tuck him in repeatedly, then you need to learn some specific techniques. Later in this chapter, I will describe some techniques you can use at night. Although if you are having trouble controlling your child all day long, you may want to seek some general help in behavior management. First, however, you should be aware of the important considerations of schedule, guilt, and psychosocial factors, as well as feedings, fears, and associations. Schedule. If limit setting at night is the only problem, then when you start to set limits properly, your child will begin falling asleep quickly and easily. But if his bedtime is set too early, before he is sleepy, then he will not be able to fall asleep, no matter how strict you are. In fact, at a too early bedtime, he may be more wakeful than at any other time of the day. Listen to the discussion that follows, and The Circadian System and the Forbidden Zone for Sleep, in Chapter 9. It makes no sense to force your child to stay in bed and try to fall asleep when he feels wide awake and his mind is active. Guilt. Setting limits at bedtime is often difficult even under the best of circumstances, and it can be far harder if your child has an underlying medical or emotional problem, or if you are unable to spend as much time with him as you'd like. You want to show your love clearly, and you worry about how your child feels when you seem to ignore his crying and pleading. And if your child is deaf, has had heart surgery, or is on chemotherapy, or if you work 2 jobs or travel a great deal, just how tough do you want to be? There is usually no easy answer. In such situations, setting necessary limits all at once may be too wrenching, and you might find it easier to follow a program that helps you regain control in a series of small steps. For example, at 1 or 2 week intervals, you could first eliminate extra television, then extra drinks, and so on, with back rubbing, sitting on his bed, and sitting in his room. Secondary gain. If failing to enforce appropriate limits at bedtime, or giving in to your child's demands at nighttime wakings, has some positive consequence for you, this so-called secondary gain can make you hesitate to change things. For example, you may enjoy cuddling with your daughter on the sofa while she falls asleep at bedtime. You just don't like having to cuddle repeatedly throughout the night. Secondary gain can also involve more complicated scenarios. In some families, the child's wakefulness at night keeps the parents from fighting, and his presence sometimes even serves to keep the two of them physically apart all night, which one or both of them may find desirable. One might say that their child is doing them a favor, at least at some level, but even if this is so, family therapy is not a job any child should have to take on. Problems at home. If limits are to be set properly at night, the child must be given proper support and nurturance during the day. The two go hand in hand. But it can be difficult to provide nurturance in a family experiencing marital difficulties, or if a parent is depressed, abuses alcohol or other drugs, or is otherwise ill. A child who does not get enough proper attention during the day may be willing to accept punishment just to get some sort of attention at night. In this context, setting limits may be difficult if it's possible at all. If major problems like these are making it hard for you, or if you are unsure even what limits should be set given the difficulties at home, I urge you to seek help. What is best in these situations varies considerably from home to home and cannot be decided without skillful counseling. Limits, associations, feedings, schedules, and fears. As I mentioned at the beginning of this chapter, several overlapping syndromes can complicate limit setting. If there is a component of associations, refer to Chapter 4, in addition to the limit-setting problem, the treatment required is basically unchanged. Different approaches are called for, however, if you have a frightened child, refer to Chapter 7, or if your child's sleep schedule is inappropriate, refer to Chapters 9 through 12. If a child who is clearly not frightened or anxious requests a series of tuck-ins at night and then goes to sleep alone and sleeps through the night, or perhaps requires at most 1 or 2 more tuck-ins during the night, the behaviors in question are part of the pre-sleep routine, but not part of the process of actually falling asleep. Unlike the situations where sleep associations become a problem, he falls asleep and wakes under the same set of circumstances. The tuck-ins have become a possibly unwelcome habit, though, and the habit persists and is reinforced because limits are not being set. Another child may request that you sit in the room or on his bed while he falls asleep. He may even hold on to you so that without even opening his eyes he can be sure you haven't left. You may have to return and repeat the process during the night when he wakes. If that happens frequently enough, you may well end up sleeping in his room part of the night. Now we have an association problem as well as a habit, because you are there when he falls asleep, but may be gone when he wakes. Both problems are treated the same way. Habits and associations may also both be present if a child sleeps with his parents all night and insists that he sleep between them while they move to the very edge of the bed. If the child also demands and receives access to the breast or bottle at each nighttime waking, there is probably an additional element of excessive feedings, which may have to be dealt with, as described in Chapter 6, before the rest of the problem can be addressed. If your child stalls with an hour of repeated requests every night at bedtime, but then sleeps through the night, his bedtime may be too early, or his time of waking too late. A schedule adjustment may be called for, rather than limit setting, or in addition to it. Refer to chapters 10 through 12. But if your child wants you in his room because he is truly frightened, not the pseudo-anxiety discussed in chapter 7, where "I had a bad dream" is just one more item on the litany of curtain calls, then setting firm limits and refusing him access to you at night could make matters worse. In that situation, you must deal with the fears first. As described in chapter 7, that may require you to sleep in his room temporarily while the fears are addressed. Taking care of his fears is the main thing that matters at first. You can still limit extra drinks, stories, and even the amount of time you spend lying in bed with him, but you should not insist that your frightened child be in his room alone. Setting limits at night. Whether or not you find setting limits difficult to do, if you have come to understand that limits are important and that a lack of limits is contributing significantly to your child's sleep problems, the suggestions in this and following sections should be useful. You will notice that the treatments of limit-setting problems may be similar or identical to those previously described for inappropriate sleep associations. That is because there may be considerable overlap between the two types of problems. If your child keeps demanding you return to do something he wants until he is ready to go to sleep, such as repeatedly tucking him in, that part is a limit-setting problem. But if you always end up interacting with him while he falls asleep, perhaps rocking him, that part becomes a problem of sleep associations. The same activity may be both. For example, if your child insists you sit in his room singing to him before and while he falls asleep. The differences between these two problems may be slight, and both problems often resolve with similar, if not identical, treatments. Your job is first to decide which of your child's behaviors and demands you would like to end, and in what ways you give in unnecessarily or inappropriately at night, and then to develop a plan that will enable you to stop these behaviors. Whichever demands and responses cause protracted bedtimes and nighttime wakings are the ones you must stop. Your child should have an appropriate bedtime routine, like those described in Chapter 3. It should take place in the room where your child sleeps, and its length should be reasonable and determined by you, not by your child. For young children, 5 to 15 minutes is usually adequate, but you may want to allow somewhat longer times if your child is of school age. Don't let the routine in the bedroom last so long that your child is not sure when it will end. Provide a warning, last story, for instance, and stick to your rules. If you give in to requests for extra stories only some of the time, those requests will still likely be repeated every night. If you want to allow a small drink before saying good night, include it in the formal routine. Do not make your child ask for it. You may decide to end with a kiss and a tuck in, and then leave. If you want to lie down with him briefly, for 1 minute perhaps, then again, it should be a formal part of the ritual, not something your child demands, and you must be prepared to leave when the time is up. If you are sloppy about enforcement, your child will learn that there is always a possibility that further demands will be rewarded. If your child is still in a crib that he cannot climb out of, and he makes demands from the crib, you need only respond briefly at progressively longer intervals, as in the treatment for association problems described in Chapter 4. The process is exactly the same. If he sleeps in your bed but cannot yet leave the room on his own, then you may have to leave the bed yourself for progressively longer intervals. You can move to a chair, for example, or even leave the room temporarily as discussed in the following section. If he is able to leave his room or follow you out of your shared room, the problem becomes a little harder. No matter how much he yells, how strong he is, or how well he can climb, you must be stronger than he is. If he ends up in control instead of you, the only lesson he will learn is that he can always get his way. Thus, if he starts coming out of his room when you refuse to keep going in, you may have to put up a gate. You may have to do that even if he sleeps in your bed, if he follows you out of the room. If he can kick down the gate, you may have to screw it into the door frame. If he can climb over it, you may have to put up a double gate, two gates, one above the other, until he agrees to stop climbing. If he can get over a double gate, you may have to start closing the door. Do whatever it takes to enforce the rule, just as you would if he tried to play with matches. You must win, because it will actually be scary for him if you do not. Only when you have successfully settled the issue will he see that you are really in charge. Only then can he stop trying to find ways to outsmart you. Only then can he stop worrying about whether you will respond supportively or angrily. And only then can he see that you are really taking care of him. Finally, then, he can relax, with no job to do except to go to sleep. And the matter is solved. You should only set limits that are necessary. Some children never come out of their room at night, whether the door is open or not, and they rarely will challenge your control. Children like that do not need a gate, and they are easy to set limits for. Other children will find a way to get out through 6 inches of open space between the top of the gate and the ceiling, and if they cannot get out, they will set about systematically destroying their room. These children desperately need to have limits imposed. Take from the discussion that follows just those techniques your child needs. The barrier or boundary. General considerations. The cornerstone of setting limits at night is ensuring that your child stays in the room where he should be sleeping. If he doesn't stay in the room, you can't enforce any nighttime rules at all. To enforce them, you must be prepared to use a barrier. Taking him back to his room over and over is not effective. In fact, he will probably perceive it as a game, especially if he has to be chased around the house or if he can sneak out of the room when you're not watching. Threats and punishments are counterproductive. A young child should not be punished for a lack of self-control at night, when self-control is hardest. Do not insist that your child take on a job that he cannot yet handle. You must take it over for him. If you dislike the idea of having a barrier, remember that in any case your young child cannot be allowed to wander freely around the house while you sleep. He may usually go to your room, true, but he could just as easily go somewhere more hazardous, such as the kitchen. He may also be confused in the middle of the night, half awake and unsure of where he is going and why, and that will put him at additional risk. Some children consciously and intentionally head away from their parents at night so they can do things that they are not normally allowed to do. A strategically placed gate at the top of the stairs or in the hallway will keep your child in a restricted part of the house and probably safe. But you are still better off requiring him to stay in the room where he sleeps and putting the gate at the doorway of that room to enforce the rule. One of the worst things you can do is leave his door open and lock your own. Now he is kept away from you, but confined to the rest of the house, while you're locked in. Who's in control now? Remember, problems such as those discussed here often start when parental controls, symbolically and physically enforced by the bars on the crib, are lost. When that happens, it is entirely reasonable to replace those controls and make his entire room a crib. The gate accomplishes that. Your child is free to wander about his room, just as he was free to move about his crib, but he cannot go anywhere else, and the gate ensures only that he stay in his room, nothing more. You cannot keep him in bed, and you shouldn't try. If at first he falls asleep on the floor by the gate, don't worry. You can always move him to his bed once he is deeply asleep, and in any case, sleeping on the floor by the gate usually stops on its own before long, unless he can see you from the gate. If he can, you are providing a temptation for him to stay by the gate instead of returning to bed. It is even worse if he can see you doing something he would like to be doing himself, such as watching television. You will find it easiest to set limits when temptations like these are gone. You would not put jelly beans on the dinner table if you didn't want your child to eat them for dinner. The gate takes away the temptation for your child to leave the room, since he can't. Closing the door to your bedroom, or the living room, or wherever you are, far enough that he won't be able to see you, takes away the temptation for him to stand there and watch. Usually a single or double gate will suffice for a child under four. If your child is a climber, avoid accordion gates with large diamond-shaped holes that he can use as finger holds and toe holds. A nylon mesh gate like a window screen or one with vertical bars will be hardest to climb. A gate is far preferable to a closed door for several reasons. Most children like to sleep with their own door open because an open door helps them feel connected to the rest of the house. That is also why children often prefer that their parents' door not be completely closed either. For the same reason, being able to hear the sounds of people moving around the house is often more reassuring than disruptive. If your child's door is completely closed, he can only imagine where you are and what is happening on the other side, and that can be scary, which is not the goal. Locking the door all night is rarely a good idea, probably never, for an otherwise normal child. You may have to close the door for increasingly long periods to help a child who is too big for a gate. Listen to the following discussion. But the eventual goal here is to have the door open, and that approach presumes he can develop enough self-control to master staying in his room. The gate should be presented as what it is, a tool to help your child stay in his room at night and keep him safe. The word help here is more than a euphemism. Many children do want to stay in the room and make their parents happy, but they just cannot overcome the temptation to leave. Closing the gate should be part of your bedtime routine. When you go into your child's room to start your stories or songs, close the gate behind you and begin with an activity that he looks forward to. If you close the gate only when you leave or when you are angry, that's what he will learn to associate it with. When you have finished your bedtime routine, quickly step over the gate or open it quickly and close it again behind you and leave. Remember to then stay out of his line of sight. It is usually a good idea to remain on the same floor as his bedroom, at least until problems have been resolved. From this point on, handle the situation just as you would if your child were in a crib and you were helping him break a pattern of inappropriate associations. Refer to Chapter 4. Follow the chart for the progressive waiting approach in Figure 4, available in your PDF companion. If he keeps calling, yelling, or crying, come back to the gate at the increasing intervals listed in the chart to reassure him briefly, and then leave again. Usually it is best not to actually enter his room, just as you would not climb into his crib unless something truly needs attention. If he throws his teddy bear or other special object out of his bed, don't go in to replace it unless he can't find it. If he loses it again, don't go in to replace it until your next scheduled trip back. There are two reasons not to go into his bedroom. First, you do not want to reward him for calling. Second, if you do go in, he may grab you, and then you will have to pull him off and race him to the gate, which is unpleasant for everyone. check on him until he falls asleep, and repeat the checks during the night as needed. The barrier or boundary. Using a gate. To properly enforce the boundary, you must first make sure the barrier is effective. If you are using a gate, remove any chairs and stools that your child could use to climb over it. Second, you must behave consistently for this plan to work. You cannot give in on occasion just because your child's crying is intense or prolonged, and you must not handle wakings in the middle of the night differently than at bedtime, or respond differently from night to night. Inconsistency is unfair to your child. It will be easiest for him to learn if your actions and responses are always consistent and predictable. Just like the inside of a younger child's crib, the room must be made safe, windows locked or protected, outlets covered, no sharp-edged furniture. If your child's behavior escalates to the point of wildness, you may have to go further. For this child, even more than for others, it is critical that you get control back. If he topples dressers, knocks over lamps, and throws toys, remove them from the room. Once something comes out, it does not go back until the nights have quieted down. In extreme cases, which fortunately are rare, it is necessary to start with the room empty, except for a mattress. If setting limits is new to you, some of the techniques suggested here may seem harsh, but an out-of-control child is not a happy child. A gate will allow you to remain calm and supportive, since you can set limits without physically restraining your child. If you are fighting with him, controlling yourself is very hard, and if you get angry and lose control, he gets the wrong message. It is much easier to continue talking to your child in a warm, reassuring, and controlled way when you are on opposite sides of a gate than when you are carrying him back to his room, kicking and hitting you. To some extent, the bigger your problems are at the start, the easier you may find setting limits to be. After all, things cannot get much worse. It can be more emotionally difficult to set limits when a child's requests are almost trivial, like asking you to pull up the covers twice a night. Meeting those requests may take no more than 10 seconds each time, but if you cannot get right back to sleep yourself after these nightly requests, your own sleep could be badly disrupted. You might have to do something about these demands for your own sake, but in this case, there is a lot of room for things to get worse before they get better if your child reacts strongly to new limits. In such situations, you have to decide whether the problem is important enough to fix and whether the time is right to fix it. On the other hand, when the problem is relatively mild, positive reinforcement, even without firm limit setting, may be all that is necessary. Listen to the discussion that follows, and the cure may prove to be as mild as the problem. Rarely do normal children actually hurt themselves in reaction to the establishment of clear, firm, and appropriate limits. Occasionally, a child will engage in self-destructive actions, such as biting his arm, banging his head into the floor or wall, scratching if he has eczema, or wheezing if he has asthma. Obviously, you cannot let truly harmful behavior go on. The goal is to stop such behavior without, at the same time, rewarding it. If your child reacts in this way, you may need some help in designing an individualized and gradual program. Fortunately, however, these situations are uncommon. Once you have regained control and your child has stopped challenging you, peace returns to the night. The hours before bedtime are free of tension. Your child stops running away when you go to put him in his pajamas. Both you and your child start to look forward to bedtime as the special time it should be. Children find that they can relax, and they are happy that they are no longer displeasing you. All of this happens because you took back control. The gate often becomes a symbol of this change, And the same child who fought the gate initially may now remind you to close it every night. It not only keeps him in his room, but it also keeps his emotions in check. The gate is an extension of you, doing what a parent is supposed to be doing, taking care of your child. If after some days or weeks your child asks that the gate be left open, try it. Some children will now be able to stay put on their own. For others, despite the best of intentions, the open doorway remains too great a temptation. Take care of each child according to his individual needs. The barrier or boundary. Using the door. For a child who is too big for a gate, probably between the ages of 4 and 6, you may have to close the door. Doing so with an older child is also possible, but the older and bigger they are, the more difficult it becomes to enforce limits with this approach. Each time your child leaves his room, take him back and close the door, keeping it closed a little longer than the time before. Because this technique requires the child to be shut behind a closed door, and the goal is to develop control, not fear, we usually start with short times, like 15 seconds, as shown in the chart in Figure 7 in your PDF companion, and slowly work up from there. If you feel that you and your child can tolerate longer times, you can start on line 3 of the chart, or lower. Close the door only if your child leaves his room, and close it only for the specified time. He should learn that his leaving his room triggers a definite response which increases each time, and over which he has no further control. Don't agree to open the door as soon as he gets back in bed, since as soon as you have opened the door, he may get out of bed again, knowing full well that he can get the door opened any time he wants. Similarly, closing the door does nothing if he can open it. Stay on the other side of the door and hold it closed as needed. If you have to, you can put a hook and eye on your side of the door so it will stay